What Live Aid seemed to show was that it might be possible to change the world. But to do it, you had to bypass all politics, because politicians, both left and right, had become corrupted by power and petty nationalism. Instead, you connected directly with others suffering around the planet and rescued them. Bob Geldof travelled to Ethiopia to visit the camps where the aid was being delivered. But he began to realise that something very strange was happening. The Ethiopian regime was rounding up thousands of the starving people who had come to the camps. They were being taken to airstrips, where they were loaded at gunpoint onto giant transport planes. They were then flown to what were called resettlement camps. Geldof was shocked by what he was seeing. To him, it seemed to evoke an evil ghost from Europe's past.
The first pictures we saw of resettlement were these ancient and beautiful people starving and in rags, under armed guard, going into these vast Russian planes. They probably have never seen a plane. They have nothing left, only their dignity. And to the West, the immediate psychological reaction is Jews being led at gunpoint into cattle trucks by the Nazis.
What Geldof had stumbled upon was something that those who ran Ethiopia had been trying to hide. That the food brought in by Live Aid was being used as a weapon in a civil war. Ethiopia's ruler was a brutal tyrant called Colonel Mengistu. Mengistu had decided that the only way to win the war was through a massive piece of social engineering. He was going to literally move millions of people out of the rebel areas in the north and relocate them in the empty south, where they could no longer fight. And the food aid was being used as bait to lure hundreds of thousands of people into the refugee camps, where his troops then swooped in and rounded them up.
Hi there, Sarge.
Howdy, boy.
Welcome to Bad Brothers Bait and Switch Store. What can I do for you today?
Well, Hoss, I got a big government supply list.
Hey, okay.
We're colonizing another asteroid.
Well, what's this one called?
Well, I don't know, just a bunch of letters and numbers. Who the hell cares? But they got some great molten lakes up there.
Oh, hot stuff.
Yeah, big old bass in them or something moving around in there. Yeah. Right. The boys are going to want to catch them no matter what.
Sure, of course.
I need some bait.
Bait.
Get this. Now, about 80 tons of night crawlers. I need 73 or 74,000 square feet of brine.
Now, hold on just a minute there.
What, too much tech talk?
No, we just sold the last of our live bait to the Ruskies for food.
They'll eat anything.
Yeah, but I just happen to have something just as good as night crawlers. Kitten hoods. Look at these things here.
Kitten hoods?
Yes, sir. 83,000 of them on special. They're velvet. And I think they're waterproof.
I'm looking for bait.
Yes, well, when these kitten hoods get wet, they smell awful. They'll attract anything.
I'm looking for bait.
Yes. Oh, God, well, look at this here. Teriyaki walking sticks. Wow. You crack those fish or whatever they are over the heads with these suckers, and if they get away, well, you just eat the sticks. The men will love them.
Listen, forget the bait.
Well,
okay?
No, wait a minute.
I ain't got time. Let's just take care of the switches.
Switches?
I need 860,000 enamel silent wall switches and plates and a wide range of decorator colors. I need 90 groves right-handed toilet foot switches.
Yeah, hold a minute there, honey. Them switches.
What'd you do, sell them to the Venusians for appetizers?
Just don't I wish. No, the supplier pulled a switch on us, but they gave us something just as good. Look at these glowing dark duck hats from Guam.
That's stupid. I need switches.
They glow in the dark. You won't need switches. The men will love them.
Listen, what about toilet switches?
Oh, I'll tell you what. I'll throw in 15 boxcars of leg sleeves. They're absorbent. The men won't need to go to the toilet.
Forget it.
No, wait a minute. Oh, Australian silly couches. They have down under. They're absorbent, too, Sarge. The men will love
them. Excuse me, sir.
Sarge, don't walk out without... Oh,
mister,
what
have you
got
a phone I could use?
Oh, yeah, you can use that phone. But hey,
thanks a lot.
You'd get a lot more use out of this here gaggle gross of digital crows. What? They're black like a phone. They do all the talking for you.
No, this will just be fine.
Oh, shucks.
I got it.
Live Aid was an extraordinary achievement. It is estimated that it may have cut the death toll in the famine by half. But the group, Médecins Sans Frontières, made the dramatic claim that the aid might have also led to the same amount of deaths as it had saved. The mass relocations were so brutal, they said, that over 100,000 people had died. It showed the weakness at the heart of the growing humanitarian movement. That when they came face to face with a brutal ruler like Colonel Mengistu, who was using their aid not to save people, but to save himself, and kill thousands more in the process, They had no way of stopping him. They couldn't challenge power. Boris Yeltsin was the president of the new Russia. He had promised to turn the country into a mass democracy. Yeltsin appointed a group of young technocrats, and they set out to do this through what they called shock therapy, advised by Western bankers and economists. They believed that they had to move fast because the communists might try and take power again. But behind it was a grander, utopian idea, that it might start the spread of democracy all around the world. But at this very moment, in the West, the opposite started to happen. The whole idea of mass democracy began to be questioned and undermined from inside the political establishment itself. It began almost unnoticed, hidden behind the wave of enthusiasm after the fall of communism. But a political scientist called Peter Mayer has argued that what happened in the 1990s was that the old idea of democracy started to disappear in the West. And it was replaced by something else, which we haven't fully comprehended yet, or even seen, because it is outside the old categories of politics. Western politicians, Mayer said, literally changed their roles. They gave up being representatives of the people, and instead, they became the agents of a new bureaucracy, which was rising up and promising that it could manage the dangerous and unpredictable force of individualism better than the politicians could. Just as the activists in China had found with Chai Ling, individualism and its drive to self-actualization can corrode and eat away at the collective power of mass democracy. Peter Mayer said the same was now happening in the West. The first politician to confront this was Bill Clinton. He came to power promising to represent what he called the forgotten middle class. But very quickly, within weeks of entering the White House, Clinton agreed to give up on many of his promised reforms and to give power over to the financial world. He did this not through any cynical motive, but because he knew that the old power base of mass politics had gone. No one joined political parties anymore. Organized labor was a vanishing force. Clinton might be in office, but he no longer had the collective power of the people behind him. The power that in the past had allowed politicians to challenge the elites in society. And in the face of that, Clinton decided to give power instead to the new force that promised that it could create a wealthier and happier society. The bankers and the economists and the management experts who were now spreading and multiplying through the corridors of Washington.
We know big government does not have all the answers. We know there's not a program for every problem. The era of big government is over.
Way back in 92, the Democrats had won. A president, we finally thought, who'll get some good things done. But now we watch in horror as his principles take flight, and Bill Clinton's moving further to the right. Puts chips in our TVs, and then we hear him say, it's going to be a federal crime to marry if you're gay. We'll keep our cities safe by locking children home at night. Bill Clinton's moving further to the right. He's dreaming of a landslide and of sweeping every state by sending Al Gore packing and by making Rush his running mate. The FBI has said, and now the whole world sees, that he learned from Richard Nixon how to watch his enemies. I voted for a president who's now nowhere in sight. Where did he go? Say it ain't so. Far to the right.
And then, of course, Dick Morris, the mother of all spin doctors. Now, here was a guy who, if his hooker friend, Sherry Rollins, had simply given her story to the tabloids 3 weeks earlier, then he would have been fired and Clinton would not have signed the welfare bill. I mean, think of how much a hooker's greed and her procrastination changed what's going on. It's just mind-boggling. And think how much low self-esteem that Dick Morris must have had to pay $200 an hour to a hooker and still have to impress her. So Clinton would talk to him not knowing that he was with the hooker. And Clinton would say, now, Dick, I need your help on this. You know I'm against all of the human rights violations going on in China. But, you know, the Republicans are saying that we need them as a market. We can't stop trading with China. It means a big difference. Meanwhile, Dick Morris is with his hooker friend, and she's just rubbing him down. He's, oh, that feels so good. Just go to the right a little bit. Clinton says, what was that? And he's saying, right there, just to the right. Go to the right. And Clinton says, okay, I got it. What we'll do is we'll say, even though we're against the human rights violations in China, since they're not 90 miles from our shore like Cuba, it's not infectious. So we're going to continue trading with them, but we are principled, and so we are not going to allow the slave laborers to hear pirated CDs. So see, just balancing like one of those dolls that never falls down.
If the new bureaucracy delivered on their promises, it was going to be a wonderful world. But if something went wrong, then the politicians would have no power with which to confront them. The shift in politics had begun. In Russia, the democracy experiment had gone out of control. The president, Boris Yeltsin, had lost all power. It had been seized by a small group called the oligarchs, who were using it to loot Russia. There was massive inflation. Millions of people were reduced to selling what they owned on the street. The life expectancy of a Russian man fell from 65 in 1987 to 58 in 1993. There was fury in the Russian parliament. Its leader accused Yeltsin of economic genocide and demanded that he stop the experiment.
No, нет.
Yeltsin responded by dissolving parliament. He cut the phone lines and sealed the building off. But a group of protesters broke through. And fighting began around the parliament and then spread to the television station. Yeltsin portrayed it as a stark battle of good against evil. He was backed by President Clinton. Clinton said it was the only way for Russia to become part of the new global economy and defeat its dangerous past. But in among the fighting was a man who believed that he knew what was really happening. Edward Limonov had been expelled from the Soviet Union 20 years before. He had lived in New York in the 1970s, the moment when the banks who now ran the global system were beginning their rise to power. Limonov was convinced that what was happening now had nothing to do with democracy. It was what he called the geopolitics of money, a force that had already enslaved the American people and now wanted to bend the Russian people to its will. And when Yeltsin ordered the tanks to attack the Russian parliament, backed by the American president and by the bankers and the economic experts, Limonov decided he was going to fight this system. Because he knew its one weakness. It told no stories about the past. And it had no vision of the future. Its only aim was to keep the system stable.
I can tell by the pie on your tie.
You're an American? Well, so am I.
Hi, Bubba. How do you do?
And while we're on the subject.
And while we're on the subject,
I'll see your wazoo!
What's that all about?
What's it all about, Mr. and Mrs. John Q. Smith from Anytown, USA?
Well, it's about this long.
And about that wide.
And it's about this country.
About which we're singing about.
I was born an American. I was raised an American. And I'll die an American in America with our millions.
Yes, we've got a lot of everything in this land of ours.
And a lot of places to put it in.
And maybe that's where you fit in. Mr. and Mrs. John Q. Smith from Anytown, USA. Come on, big fella. Take this guitar, put on this wide belt and work shirt, and tell it like it was.
Give me that guitar. All right, everybody. It's a little song. Now, thank you very much. A little song I learned upstream in prison one day. Everybody sing along now. Ready now? This land is made of mountains. This land is made of mountains. This land is made of mud. This land is made of mud. This land has lots of everything. This land has lots of everything. For me and Elmer Fudd. For me and Elmer Fudd. This land has lots of trousers. This land has lots of trousers. Mousers. This land has lots of mousers. And pussycats to eat them when the sun goes down.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Stop!
It wasn't always like that.
No, first they had to come from little towns with strange names like
Smegma,
Spasmodic,
Frog,
and the far-flung Isles of Langerhands.
But who were they?
We were small, angry men with hairy faces and burning feet. We were running away from poverty, intolerance, and the law.
And the army.
And we took to them.
And they took to us.
And what do you think they took?
Oil from Canada, gold from Mexico, geese from the neighbor's backyard, boom, boom. Corn from the Indians, tobacco from the Indians, Dakota from the Indians, New Jersey from the Indians, New Hampshire from the Indians, New England from the Indians, New Delhi from the Indians.
Indonesia for the Indonesians!
Yes, Veterans Day.
But we couldn't do it alone.
Now we needed the hope, the faith, the prayers, the fears.
The sweat, the pain, the boils, the tears.
The broken bones.
The broken homes.
The total degradation of...
Who?
You, the little guy.
And across him all, we flung one shining steel rail.
Rockefeller.
Rock.
Rockefeller,
make one shining steel rail from sea to mighty sea, from coast to mighty coast, from Bangor all the way to mighty Maine.
Limonov had visited the Serbian nationalists who were besieging the city of Sarajevo. He was the guest of their leader, Radovan Karadzic. Karadzic told him about the powerful nationalism that was now reawakening after the fall of communism.
Serbs used to possess the entire ground. We own this country. This is our country. Turks have been here occupiers and the Muslims are successors of those occupiers.
So the traditional imposed geopolitics.
Geopolitics, yeah. Yes, exactly. Ovo je gospodin Limonov, pisac ruski, veoma, veoma poznat.
Limonov became notorious when he was then filmed firing a machine gun in what seemed a random manner into the city below.
You are very courageous people. You, despite the anything what is against you, it's a great power of almost
almost the entire 15, world.
Yeah, 15 countries against you, and you resist. And I repeat again, we Russians, we should take example from you.
Limonov realized that something was re-emerging from the past in Bosnia that might have the power to confront the new system of global money. It was nationalism and the national myths that came with it. They were powerful stories that linked people together and gave them a collective power, something that individualism could never do. But as individuals were beginning to feel the limitations of their power, the new class that had grown up to manage them was growing stronger and more confident. And they began to see democracy not just as something to be bypassed, but as a potentially dangerous force. By the mid-1990s, technocrats in the political think tanks in the West were becoming frightened that elections all across the world were producing what they called the wrong kind of result. In Algeria, a party called the Islamic Salvation Front took the majority of votes in the first round of an election. It was a stunning victory. But people feared that its real aim was to turn the country into an Islamist state and get rid of democracy. Western politicians found themselves supporting a military coup that stopped the elections. And in Europe, the extreme right paraded openly. They protested against the immigrants coming from Africa and the Middle East.
The foreigners take away houses in Germany, bring drugs and all kinds of filth. They steal German workplaces and they filthy up the environment.
For me, now, the most important inspiration is Adolf Hitler.
But in 1934, in Germany, the specter of doom was rising its shrouded head in agony.
Das ist immer ein Auto! Und ich rauf mir einen putzen Volkswagen! Und niemand steht von Schwellpizza!
And faced by the horror in the Balkans, President Clinton's representative, called Richard Holbrook, brought the question out into the open. Suppose elections are free and fair, he said, and those elected are racist, fascist, separatists. That is the dilemma. An American political scientist called Farid Zakaria put it more bluntly. The people, we are told, he said, are the most important. We are driven by the phrase, the American people are not stupid. But what if they are?
Yeah, I mean, okay. Let's look between two idiots. Look, you're an idiot and I'm an idiot.
Okay,
we both know
but
that.
I'm the head idiot of my country.
Okay, you can be the head idiot of your country if I can be the head idiot of my country.
I'll grant you
what
that.
What about all those little countries
look
in between?
Those two dumb guys.
Okay, what did you say?
Well, what about all these little countries in
those
between?
Those little countries, look at them. They're full of idiots.
Those guys
they're
are
full of idiots just like us.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Hey, you here. Little idiots, any of you idiots why? Over there want to come over here with us idiots and solve this war?
We're the heads of the pin trust over here.
We're not smart enough to understand about that kind of
we're
stuff.
The dummies.
We're
oh,
dumb.
Yeah,
we're
well,
the dummies.
Look, I'm the dumbest guy in my country.
That's true.
And you're the dumbest guy in your country.
I'll come and live in your country.
That's
then
a good
I won't
idea.
Have to be the dumbest guy anymore.
I'll go over to your country, too. It'll be great. Those Moscow girls really knock me out.
Golly.
They leave the West behind.
But the political scientists were not alone in distrusting people. For at the same time, a group of behavioural psychologists, who were becoming increasingly influential, were insisting that individuals also made the wrong decisions in the marketplace. They were not behaving in the logical, self-interested ways that economics said they should. The most famous of them was called Daniel Kahneman. He would win a Nobel Prize for his work. For 30 years, Kahneman had been studying human behavior. And he had discovered, he said, that human beings actually had two systems inside their brains. One of them they were aware of, which they thought was in control. The other was an instinctive part that really drove most of their actions, a part that they were completely unaware of. This new psychology was a powerful attack on the whole idea of the confident self. Because the picture the psychologists painted of human society was of millions of individuals living most of the time thinking that they were rational and in control, while something else inside them was really guiding many of their actions, without them knowing it. But, Kahneman said, there was an underlying pattern to this irrational behaviour. It meant that if somehow you could gather enough data on human beings' behaviour, you could see the patterns and so predict what they would do and manage them. But to do that, you would have to bypass and ignore their conscious self, because it was the behaviour, not the thoughts, that counted. In Russia, President Yeltsin had lost all control. He was drunk most of the time.
Listen, this bar doesn't serve anything but 69-cent bar scotch. That's all you get here.
That's good?
It's terrible.
I tell you something. I took 43 drinks waiting to get on a plane from Burbank to Oxnard yesterday.
Yeah, I've waited down. That's at Interplanetary Airport Central,
Contrapole. Yeah, well, it's as close as possible to where I live, if you want to call that a living.
I understand. 65 drinks, you took.
48, actually.
That was a good year for bar scotch.
I was absolutely destroyed. I got up to 20,000 feet, and I began to see people with weapons in the plane. Well, they were there, of course.
Oh, well.
But you can't see them until you get that far.
All right, is everybody here now? I think we can begin.
He had become the puppet of the oligarchs, who had taken over all the media and blocked any opposition. But there was one opponent. It was Edward Limonov. He had started his own tiny party. He called it the National Bolsheviks. It was, he said, a fusion of fascism and communism, and the party flag was designed to show this. But it wasn't simple nostalgia. Limonov wanted to shock people out of accepting the completely corrupt society around them. He wanted to go back to the original roots of fascism and nationalism. To the idea that if you can find a story powerful enough to inspire people, you can then use that collective power both to sweep away the corrupt rulers and change reality. It was something that had been wiped and forgotten because of the horrors it had led to in the past. And the individualism that had been promoted so strongly in the West after the Second World War had been a force shield against that. A shield of one world, composed of just individuals. Limonov was the reappearance of the frightening old dream. The third person to join the party was the musician Yegor Letov. He had led the opposition to communism in the 1980s. Now he sang songs about how Russia was trapped in a frozen world, buried under a mass of meaningless, broken fragments from the past. By now, politicians in the West had given large amounts of their power away. What had begun with Bill Clinton in the early 1990s had spread. When Tony Blair came to power, he had immediately given control over much of the economy to the Bank of England. But in 1998, the global financial system showed how unstable it could be. An economic crisis that began in Russia and then spread to Asia had consequences throughout the world. In response to the crisis, the Bank of England had insisted that interest rates be raised. But this made many British goods too expensive to export. And in the north of England, factories began to close.
So the way each individual actually lives is political, in the most decisive sense of that word. It is action in one's own life that counts. When enough people have decided to live differently, the political results will follow naturally and easily, and the old political forms will simply be swept away in the flood. Although we seem to be living in the worst of times, it is already possible to visualize the unfolding of a revolution. The new consciousness will spread, and whatever it gives life to, a university, a public school, a factory, a city, and finally the courts, the Congress, and the presidency will become responsive to human needs, even a radio station.
I think about I can't understand with the cat, though, is that he, at least from my point of view, doesn't understand that factories, as a way of life, are in no way can they be changed incrementally or can they be made more responsive to human things. They are the pits.
Seeks to transcend science and technology to restore them to their proper place as tools of man rather than as the determinants of man's existence. It is by no means anti-technological. It does not want to break machines, but it does not want machines to run men. It makes the wholly rational assertion that machines should do the bidding of man who knows and respects his own nature and the natural order of which he is a part. Third, the new consciousness seeks new ways to live in the light of what technology has made both possible and desirable.
But he digs factories. He says, can you imagine a good factory?
He doesn't dig factories. He says we have factories and the form that people have used to run these factories has become the kind of thinking apply to life.
But the work is a bummer. Working for somebody else
right.
is a bummer.
Well, the new consciousness seeks new ways to live. Since machines can produce enough food and shelter for all, why should not man end the antagonism derived from scarcity and base his society on love for his fellow man?
But look at the food you get made by machines. It's bad food. It's not as good as the food that people just organically grow in the earth and relate to. That's what I'm saying. He's a technocrat.
Well,
he's a humanist technocrat.
Perhaps you're right.
Tony Blair insisted, though, that it was a price the country had to pay for being part of what he called the world economy.
You can say world economy till he's blue in the face, but it's not just us, is it? It's other people.
He can say, Mr. Blair can say world economy.
He can say it's world economy. You can say, oh, world economy, but...
So what do you
people
say?
People in the Northeast are suffering. But why is he giving all that power to the Bank of England? Why? Well, you know, why is that? Is he passing the buck? What's he doing? So he can't be blamed for things like this that go wrong. He can say, oh, well, it's the Bank of England's interest rates and all the rest of it. I don't know.
They're just opening their mouths and letting the wind waffle their tongues about, as far as I'm concerned. Get up here and get things sorted. You vote the Labour government in, you vote for them all your life, and this is the crap you get off them.
You think it's all wrong what's happened? What could they have done?
Give us more support, stepped in, put a shoulder behind us, show a bit more muscle. Just let them know that they can't do this.
And at the end of the century, a new anger began to grow, out in the margins of England, that in the future would get mixed up with the furies of the past. But the politicians increasingly found that there was little they could do to respond to this anger. Because over the past 10 years, all kinds of new organisations had grown up that were deliberately designed to limit the politicians' power. Because national politics was dangerous to the stability of the global system. The idea had originally come from technocrats inside the European Union. One of the leaders was a political scientist called Giandomenico Maione. Politicians, Maione said, were always driven by short-term, self-interested motives, which meant that they too were irrational. The solution, he said, was to bypass the politicians completely.
Vous avez des problèmes avec le pacte de stabilité?
Pardon?
Avez-vous des problèmes avec le pacte de stabilité?
Pas tellement.
And in the 1990s, behind the scenes of the political debate in the European Union, Maione and a group of technocrats created a range of new institutions that were deliberately designed to avoid political interference and instead run large areas of society in a rational way. Maione gave them a boring bureaucratic name. He called them non-majoritarian institutions. But in reality, they were a completely radical invention that challenged the very idea of democracy. These new organisations, Maione said, are by design not directly accountable to voters or to their elected representatives. Out of it was going to come the massive range of new bureaucracies that today run large parts of the modern world. Not just central banks, but all kinds of regulatory agencies, special courts and expert bodies, all of which govern not through political policies, but through rational, scientific assessment and measured outcomes. And the European Union became the centre of this experiment. In front of House, the elected politicians debated subjects like human rights, but continually failed to come to any conclusion.
Noi dobbiamo apprestare una serie di garanzie, una serie di protezioni per I cittadini.
Are we concerned with rights or with political objectives? And much of what we're going to discuss today is...
Personnellement, je pense que les femmes méritent d'avoir deux articles dans la charte et pas un seul.
But quietly, behind the scenes, what were being created were, in Maione's words, specialised institutions, staffed with neutral experts, carrying out policies with a level of efficiency and effectiveness politicians cannot and never will achieve.
Let's go where I go every morning, centrally located and barely a stone's throw from the tomb of the unregistered voter, downstairs in the historic old grid building.
Hello, Clive.
Ah, come on in, Chester.
Well, thank you very much. Hi. Thank you very much.
Hey, you're just in time to help me check out this new model government.
Yeah?
Yeah, they just brought it down, and they say it explains everything.
Well, you know, it sure is big.
Hey, well, look over there in the left end. That's where you work, there in the Bureau of Western Mythology.
By golly, we're at proud service of the Lost Electricity Reclamation Agency, Senator.
Yeah, well, the LES is under the left... I think I'll just plug it in.
Oh, right? Well, listen, I'll just use this little plug right down here.
Not that plug, Chucko. See?
Oh, that's terrible.
You've got to plug in the female. Yeah. Listen to it. Teaches you, huh?
Yeah.
Half of what comes in here?
Must go out there.
Righto. Let's see what it does with this fine miniature boxcar of industrial coke.
Okay. Look at that.
That's
amazing.
Let's see. It's pumped from the Veterans Tap Dance Administration.
Goes up here to the Assistant Secretary of Leftovers.
Flip-flop down to the Secretary of Covers.
Right. Now watch it go now around the Department of Spies.
Into the office of the Secretary of Failure himself, wouldn't you know? That's shoes for industry, Charlie.
And it's food for thought, you know, Mr. Brown?
Yeah, but we're talking about power, Chucko.
Well, I know you are. You wouldn't be here.
Look at that.
Yes, sirree.
It heard the word power, and it responded just like we do. And here it comes. Here comes our ox cart right back to Earth. Smack dab on the middle of the Small Animal Administration.
Well, I must say that's the most incredible demonstration, but where are the humans, officer?
Why, they're right here, son, waiting in the lobby to use the power of that ton of coke.
Oh, then we must be very near the president, Mr. Devers.
Yes, Dagwood. He's the terminal boss, the output.
I'll bet you he really puts out.
The original idea behind mass democracy had been that the politicians would be the bridgehead for the people into power. They would challenge the powerful groups at the top of society on behalf of the people. But then the people, driven by the new individualism, had retreated into their own private worlds. So the politicians switched sides and became instead the representatives of the new powerful technocratic class. It still looked like they were powerful and had control over events. But now the people had gone. Beneath them was a void. But in 1999, Tony Blair realized that there might still be a way to change the world dramatically and recapture some of that power. The conflict between the Serbs and the Muslims in the Balkans had erupted again. Serbian nationalists were attacking the Albanian population in Kosovo. Blair worked hard to persuade a reluctant President Clinton to join in a bombing campaign to force the Serbs to stop the ethnic cleansing. And it succeeded. Tony Blair came to Kosovo and was welcomed as a hero. At the refugee camp, Blair presented what they had done as an expression of that epic vision that Bernard Kouchner had put forward 20 years before. We are all one world, linked together simply as individuals, not divided by political ideas or by nations. And we, the good politicians in the West, have a duty to intervene, to help the victims of all evil dictators, wherever they are in the world.
This is not a battle for territory. This is a battle for humanity. It is a just cause. It is a rightful cause to make sure that these people, innocent people, who have been driven from their homes at the point of a gun, are allowed by the world community, acting together, back to their homeland, back to Kosovo, so these people can become symbols of hope, humanity, and peace. Thank you.
And the new ruler of the independent Kosovo, appointed by the United Nations, was Bernard Kouchner.
We were taking significant step towards stability and democratic self-government in Kosovo.
In the 1990s, the triumph over communism had ushered in a new era. Liberal politicians in the West had willingly given up much of their power in the interests of the greater good, of global stability. The power had gone first to the global financial system. And now, It was being given to the American military as well. It looked like a new world. But underneath, the old forces of money and military power were reassembling and resuming their dominance, just as they had in the pre-democratic days of the old empires. And that was going to lead to other strange forces rising up and coming back to haunt the West.
Oh, that's all.
Odds balls! Tis King Bernardo's ghost again! Evacuating to the morning mist on Abbey Sheet!
Edmond, my bonny lad!
Come not so close, old spirit cold, or I'll shred thy shift with me lancelot bold!
Hold off for more! What be thy name, ye rusty clod?
A Pete of Pike, dead sire. A Pike's Pete, a simple man.
Then gae the simple, stupid way a bid. Though we be King Bernardo yet, we shall relieve thee of thy watch.
Me watch? Saint Mickey's hands, he took me watch. That's no relief to me. So unrelieved, I must relieve myself upon yon mossy rampart wall and write in steaming streams Bernardus Rex and dot the I for king. Had I but water left in time, I'd fill a moat twixt dreadful wraith and me. Oh, I am afraid and fear!
Put up thy piddling pike, you fool. That shade beneath the winding sheet was I, and I'm Sir Andrew Lunch, the same as e'er. Thy rascally relief and faithful battle mate.
Me battle mate, you mean? Your counterfeit fire put me pants afloat. It's only right you fill him up again.
Fear not, wet Peter, for thee I've brought honest spirits in the drunkard's sack. Here's breakfast toast enough for both of us. Come, fill thy winkling tiny cup.
Odds tonsils, we'll meet the dawn with peckers up.
Oh, what's that?
'Tis truly King Bernardo come at dawn. See where he stands upon yon battlements.
He seems to float with no more substance than me breath. Slip thee to Buttery Down and fetch the prince.
I go. We'll meet again. I hope.
Tis surely he sports the sacred hat upon his shroud.
Eternal sleeps its moistly upon my face these clammy nights. Once more I walk these slippery, withering heights in aimless, mindless searching for a man with blunted aim and motley tights.
But, sweet my lord, I have.
No, sweet Marie, I'm speaking to these soldiers here.
Mark, it seems to float like oil upon the sea.
I'll be not gulled. Hand me my sword flask, man.
What use is sober steel against a ghost, my prince?
A ghost?
It hops up King Bernardo's crumbling tower, my lord.
The goats?
The ghost, sweet prince.
Methought they spoke of goats upon the battlements.
Nay, ghost, my lord.
Well, be he ghost or goat, or ghost of goat or both, our spirits need to goad my spirits on.
See, the spook will speak with thee.
He perches there upon the tower's tipply top.
I'm here, deceased parent.
Thou poor unfocused prince, give thee a nod to Norway.
Back to school? I learned there all I could and burned it down. I doubt they'll have me back.
To Norway go, where nights like day are followed fast by days of endless night and books of Viking dames quaff unworthy.
Do not, sweet virgin prince. This thy father's fernal shade leads thee up to hell.
If that be hell, I'll toot and snort at fate.
As a tiny tot, my mother told me not to cross the moat. But then the monk, he did bespeak me, cast the moat from mine own eyes. And so confused, I crossed mine eyes and double-crossed the monk who fell into the moat. Are we not men?
Not I, my lord.
Yes. If we fall down, can we not rise again? Hot-headed, flushed with blood, we'll not take it lying down. We'll stand it up and get it any way we can.
To Norway, Edmund!
I, dear dead dad, I'll abdicate the crown, my coronation skip, and leave at once to be your midnight sun. But first, let me embrace thee.
Hey, stay back!
I'll clamber up to hug thy clammy draperies. I'll race to ruin. I'll bite thy wan and waxen lips and draw refreshing nectar from thy hollow kiss.
Stay, don't cut. I need to skip away.
And so he does.
Shows his knees, revealing blue and gooshly flesh.
Stay, royal parent.
Edmund reaches out, yet touches nay but air.
He's gone.
Tis done.
Tis done.
This way, tis done. Tis done. He's gone.
He's fallen to the sea.
Follow not, Prince Edmund, lest a ghost ye be.
King Bernardo walks again and bids me leave. What does this mean? Come, men, and you, Marie. Bring on the nuts and ales and meat. We'll speak of this anon.